This podcast may contain content that is graphic and disturbing in nature. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Women in Crime. We are really excited to bring you this new podcast about all things related to women in the criminal justice system. Our voices might sound familiar to those of you who listen to Direct Appeal, story about famous suitcase murderer Melanie McGuire, who was convicted for the murder and dismemberment of her husband and who is currently serving a life sentence. For those of you who don't know us, my name is Megan Sachs, and I am a criminologist, and I have been for the last 10 years. I write and research on topics including bail reform, sex offender policies, and women in crime. And this is my co-host, Amy Schlossberg.
Hello, I am Amy Schlossberg, and I am also a criminologist. However, my focus is different. My focus is on the causes and remedies of wrongful conviction and offender reentry and reintegration. Happy to be back, Megan.
So excited to be here and really excited to bring you this new podcast. This is episode one, the Betty Broderick story. Have you ever heard of Betty Broderick, Amy?
You know, the name sounds familiar, but I can't place it, to be honest. So,
okay. Well, like I said, I first heard about this case when I was younger. Actually, I was watching the news with my mother when I was probably 11 or 12 and should not have been watching this type of information. And I saw this case about a woman who had murdered her ex-husband and his wife. And then right after, I remember my mother was watching the movie that came out, The Betty Broderick Story, and this was with Meredith Baxter Burney. And I remember the movie was really shocking and she was really good and we were both sort of hooked into it, what can I say? So let's talk about who Betty Broderick is. Well, her name is actually Elizabeth Broderick. She grew up in New York and attended an all-girls college. And that was right around Eastchester, New York. And she met her husband, Dan Broderick, at a Notre Dame game in 1965. So Dan was in college there and Betty was attending a game. There was a difference in age between the two of them. So Betty was a couple of years younger. I think she was just about to go to college. And Dan was a couple of years in. And Betty described Dan as being kind of this geeky type. He had talked about how he was going to go to medical school right after. And Betty was quite beautiful. She was a young sort of socialite from a, you know, good family, good area. She recalled that she was going back, you know, she was excited to start college at the time. But Dan actually, you know, got her number and he wooed her. He really pursued her. And she said that he was persistent and his persistence over a couple of years wound up paying off. So they eventually married a few years later. I think it was 1969 when they married, and they had their first child in 1970. Well, Betty would go on to actually support Dan and a burgeoning family, I guess you would say, while Dan went to medical school, and he went to Cornell Medical School. And Betty, with her education, I believe her degree was in early education, became a teacher. So Dan goes on to medical school, which is rough. You know, they have a small child, and I believe they had a second one not too far after. And he finishes medical school, and you probably think, well, that's a great moment, right? Like, all right, medical school is done. He's going to go on to become a doctor. Well, that's not what happened here. Dan announced after he finished medical school that, in fact, he did not want to practice medicine and that he intended to go right on to law school. And Betty supported this decision, and he actually went to Harvard Law School. So
were they well off?
They weren't, no. I actually remember Betty describing their first, I think one of their first beds for the daughter was not, you know, it was like a drawer, you know, blankets in a drawer of a dresser. So no, they were not well off at all. But she stood by him. And I mean, he did go to Harvard Law School. So there you go.
Smart guy, yeah.
Super smart guy. Mm. So he went to law school and he finished and he went on to combine these two. So medical school and law school, his background, to become a successful medical malpractice attorney in San Diego, in La Jolla. Basically, through most of the 1970s, Betty's working, Dan is, he's going to school. And finally, you know, he got this job, and I think it was by like the early 1980s, maybe 1980, 1981, after a lot of years of struggling and hard work, the Brodericks kind of arrive on the scene. So they become this socialite family in La Jolla. They have four children at the time. And as Betty would say, quite frankly, they were doing well. They had money now. They had houses. They belonged to the country club. They were taking ski trips. She said we could finally breathe. This was it. All of the hard work had paid off, you know, for 10 years. And this was, they were still young. I think they were still in their 30s. So life is looking good for them. But then Betty describes that there would be a change in Dan's behavior at some point as he becomes more successful. And he really was a successful attorney, described that way by almost everyone who knew him. He was earning something, I think, like maybe about $1 million a year. And this is in 1980. Mm-hmm. So he's doing well. She says she noticed that he started to go through like a midlife crisis. And what's the first sign?
Do you know? Buying a car.
And what do you buy when you have a midlife crisis? Does anyone know? A
sports car of some sort? I don't know.
He came home with a red Corvette. And
so cliche.
Exactly. So he came home with the red Corvette, and she said that she recalled buying a book that was like how to survive a midlife crisis. And she said that she did things like try to make herself better. So improve herself, you know, whether it was, I can't remember, she said cosmetic surgery, but she lost weight and she was already thin. She was an attractive woman, but, you know, she thought, okay, well, if he's going through something, I'm going to work on this too. But then something happened that would surprise Betty a lot, because she said that she never knew Dan to be interested in other women. And she said they had an office party, and it was his office party, and she was invited. And she said at this party, it was the first time where she would be introduced to Linda Colquina. And Linda Colquina would eventually go on to become an integral part of this case. But she was a very young, new office assistant. I believe Linda was 21 or 22 at the time. Very, very attractive. Mm-hmm. And Betty said this was the first time she had ever heard Dan say to another person, "Wow, look at how pretty this woman is." And she said it was kind of like a jolt. Mm-hmm. She said, you know, up until that time, Dan never talked about other women in that way. So this was her first inkling that something was wrong. But she also said she didn't think that it was a big deal, right? Like, she's not going to see Linda very often. She's just some office. She's a temp. I think she was a temp at the time. So she didn't really think that this was going to be such a big deal. But Linda would go on to become a regular office assistant, and Dan would hire her pretty quickly as his personal assistant. Betty became, I will tell you this, so she became, I mean, the pinnacle of violence was probably, she became so enraged with a round of like legal papers that he served her, that she drove her car, her truck, her SUV maybe it was, through the door, the front door of his house.
Oh my God.
Yeah, this was violent. And Dan had her arrested. I believe Dan had her committed to a mental institution or a psychiatric facility for a short time at one point. Now, her version of the story is that Dan was making her crazy. He was making her nuts. He was trying to make it seem crazy so that he would do better in divorce court. He antagonized her. He and Linda were antagonizing her. She said that she would get letters or pictures of Dan and Linda together, and that she would also get anti-wrinkle cream and weight loss products in the mail.
So was this Linda harassing her back?
Well, this is what Betty was saying. She said clearly.
Was that corroborated, or is that just based on her word? Like, I'm wondering if that's just her lying.
I think that was just Betty's word.
Yeah.
Although she may have told a friend at the time. She still had friends at the time, too. So, you know, remember, they're both still residing in La Jolla. And, you know, she claimed that Dan used the courts to further abuse her. There was a legal loophole he had used to sell their house. So they had a joint house. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to sell it. And she didn't want to. Or she wanted a certain price. And so he used I don't know what the loophole was, but he was able to actually sell the house without her permission.
Hmm.
Now, some people might have said, like, that's crazy. I can't believe, you know, he was able to do that and whatnot. However, they received a couple of offers on the house, to which she said no. And he just said, I'm never going to be able to do this. Mm-hmm. She's never going to say yes. So a lot of this also becomes whose perspective are you going to believe, okay? So they go back and forth. There's a final settlement. Dan gets custody of the children. In the final settlement, Betty got almost nothing in terms of like a lump sum financial settlement. And because Dan actually used a California law that that allowed the earning spouse to split debt incurred after separation on, I think, community properties. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it came out at the end, the judge said something like splitting it up would mean that Betty would actually owe Dan money. I think she got something like $30,000, which seems
enraged
a little...
Enraged her, I'm assuming.
I'm sure that enraged her, but she did get a house in La Jolla worth about, I think, I saw a couple different reports, so estimates were between $650,000 and $750,000. Mm-hmm. And she also got alimony, remember, not child support because he had the children. Mm-hmm. She got alimony in the amount of $16,000 a month. So we're talking about almost $200,000 a year mm-hmm. and a house in La Jolla. And some people might say that's actually more than fair, also considering that Betty was young and she could still work. Yeah. I mean, this is not someone who was not capable of going out and finding a job at this point, even though she hadn't and she sacrificed a lot. But she was obviously furious over it. Also, because the divorce was finalized, it meant that Dan and Linda were free to get married. Mm-hmm. So Dan and Linda got married pretty quickly after in April 1989. Dan got security for the wedding because Betty had threatened to kill him. And it turns out that a couple of his friends and security advisors wanted Dan to wear a bulletproof vest.
It was that bad.
It was that bad.
Wow. So did Betty have firearms or was it?
Betty did have a firearm.
And they knew that, obviously. Okay.
I don't know if they knew that she had a firearm. It was just revealed later on in the reports that she got a firearm right around the time Dan and Linda got married.
Okay.
So he refused, though. He said, I got security. I'm not going to be held hostage by my ex-wife. And then he also said reportedly that, you know, if she kills me, it's like killing the golden goose because he was still supporting her financially.
Yeah.
So still paying that $16,000 a month.
She'd be screwing herself.
That's essentially what he was saying. So, okay, they get married in November 1989. Betty and Dan have been divorced, but they still have legal battles because they're still going back and forth. Apparently, Betty is still leaving these obscene messages on in their machine, calling Dan awful names and Linda always the bimbo, the whore, how's your whore? And it kind of went on, and Dan filed more restraining orders against her. And I guess she had just gotten served with another round of legal documents, legal papers, and this was right before her 42nd birthday. And one night in November 1989, again, right before her birthday, she took her daughter's key and she went over to Dan and Linda's home. And she unlocked the door, went in. This is in the early morning hours, I believe between 4 and 5 a.m. She went up to their room while they were sleeping and she shot at them. She shot the couple. She first hit Linda with two bullets and they killed her pretty instantly. The bullets killed her pretty instantly. But after she shot Dan, he was still alive and he actually crawled down from the bed to the floor and he was trying to take cover and reach for the phone. And he apparently said to her, okay, you got me. And she went over and ripped the phone out of the wall so that he couldn't, you know, pick up the phone and call the cops. She took the phone and she left. And she called her daughter.
She kill him?
He died.
He died as well.
No, Dan and Linda both died. Linda would die instantly, so no pain. Dan, unfortunately, his lung would bleed out, so it would be slower.
Jeez.
So it was.
Were any of the children home at the time?
No. Okay. None of the children were in the house at the time. And so Betty called one of her children afterwards. She called the daughter, one of the daughters, and one of her daughters came and basically got her. Before we get there, she called a daughter, but Betty also had, I might add, Betty had a boyfriend at the time. Yeah. Betty's got a boyfriend who had been reportedly living with her for quite some time. They had been dating for a couple of years.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting development because you think that she's the woman scorned and upset, but yet she's also having a relationship. So she had called her daughter also. What happened was that her boyfriend and one of the neighbors went over to Dan and Linda's because Betty said to the daughter or to one of them, I've killed him. I've killed Dan and Linda.
Oh, she made an initial confession.
She made a confession right away.
Interesting.
She called them and said, I've killed him. I killed the son of a bitch, something of that nature. And they were just not sure, like, is this Betty talking, you know, or did she really do this? So they went over to the house and they found them really quickly, called the cops. And Betty would actually turn herself in later that day with her daughter, and she never denied committing the murders, ever. The community was shocked too, of course. They're shocked about this happening in, you know, this prestigious neighborhood. On the one hand, you have a vicious murder. But on the other hand, you also have people who hunkered down in Betty's camp pretty quickly. Oh, yeah. She's the loyal wife who was dumped after making her husband a success and replaced by the younger version of her.
That doesn't give you the right to kill your husband, your ex-husband, though. Like, yes, she was wrong. But why would anyone side with someone who murdered two people in cold blood?
A lot of women. Women who were sick of husbands, you know, they were sick of being the second, you know, what's that, the first wives club?
Yeah.
They were sick of being dumped by the husband who made his success off their backs.